the UCR Podcast.
Here's another one for all of our guitar heroes out there. If you've been keeping up with the podcast, you know that we had Steve Vai as a guest this past week. And if you missed that one, you're definitely going to want to go back and check it out. Steve and I spoke about a lot of different subjects, including doing the G3 tour with his lifelong friend, Joe Satriani. Steve and Joe put out their first ever collaboration last year, a song called The Sea of Emotion, Part 1, and revealed that they are working on an album together. They did a run of dates last year and are making it band official here in 2025 with the group that they are calling Satch Vai, featuring a lineup that also includes drummer Kenny Aronoff, bassist Marco Mendoza, and guitarist Pete Thorne. Dates kick off June 13th and are presently set to run through the end of July. And in addition to all of that, Steve and Joe got back together in early 2024 with their old pal Eric Johnson to reunite for the first time since all three toured together for the inaugural run of the G3 tour back in 1996. They've recently put out a live album, G3 Reunion Live, commemorating those shows. Guys, if you're like me, maybe you've bought nearly every live album that Steve, Joe, and Eric have put out over the years. I'm here to tell you that you don't want to miss this one. It's got full sets from each of them in the version of Spanish Castle Magic that they play in the encore. It's something else. They jam for close to 12 minutes on that one. You can grab G3 Reunion Live wherever you get your music. Conveniently, they've got a purchase link at the tour's official website, g3tour.com. So, with all this G3 talk, I was able to grab Joe Satriani. We spent some time chatting about G3 and a bunch of other subjects. You know, I've talked to Satch a lot. I had never heard the story regarding his performance at the Montreux Jazz Festival, and that is something which made me go back and give the video of that performance a fresh watch. If you are new to the podcast, give us a follow so you will receive future episodes. And if you like what you hear, please rate and review. Feel free to share additional thoughts, feedback, and suggestions by emailing me, wardlaw@ultimateclassicrock.com. Now, let's get into our conversation with Joe Satriani. Well, it is so great to have this new G3 Reunion Live package. You and I have talked briefly about this in the past, but like, I'm always going to be the guy who's pulling for you to do more vocal stuff. So it's fun having Big Bad Moon in the set list here. It got a fair amount of rock radio play at the time, but I doubt that you anticipated it would become a fan favorite in the way it has.
I'm so happy that it has. I mean, it is... The process of doing that was so innocent and organic. You know, I wanted to play harp really bad, and I didn't know how, really. I watched my brother play blues harp when I was a kid, and he was a natural at it, but I never got the proper lessons from him. So I reached out back then in 89 to Norton Buffalo, who's a just the greatest ever American harp player. And he spent about 4 or 5 hours with me and tried to teach me the right way to play harmonica. But I took those lessons and went right into the studio, and I was very inspired. And, you know, I'm not a real singer, so I just imagine a character, you know, and I just become this other character, and that helps me sort of not be so shy about singing. But it all came together, and we had so much fun in the studio. We were just like kids, like making stuff up, but it got me, it gave me a chance to apply some of my blues playing in a way that the instrumentals really wouldn't, you know, because it's just a whole different sensibility when you're doing an instrumental. And so we never knew how that was going to go over. The video was traumatic to make back then in the 89. And we had problems with MTV, who made us change the video because they thought we were going to teach kids to get electrocuted or I don't know what. So the history of the thing. And then, of course, doing it live is weird because I have to play, and then I have to play harmonica and then play slide, and then...
It gives you a whole appreciation for what somebody like Neil Young does, where he does that all the time, like doing the two things together.
Yeah. Some people just, you know, my favorite slide player is Joe Walsh, because when Joe plays slide, it's like new music. he's not showing you like, look who I'm copying. I'm cool, you know, because I'm playing just like this guy or that guy. He just doesn't. He just plays some brand new Joe Walsh music. Vibrato's great. Intonation's great. Timing's flawless, you know. So I don't play any slide, anything like him, but that's who I aspire to play like.
Yeah, and it's crazy too, man, because like I've heard this a lot about like, say, Eddie Van Halen, where people talk about how every time you saw Eddie playing, he was smiling, like he was happy to play. And I think you could apply that same thing to Walsh. Like, you look at Walsh and he always looks happy to be doing what he's doing. And he's one of those guys that like, he takes the slide thing and he makes it look easy. And it's like, guys like that, for you as a guitar player, you got to look at that and just be like, man, how do they do that? How do they make that look as easy as they do?
Yeah. And you know, just if we get really, we nerd out on and get super technical, he never frets with the slide. And a lot of slide players, that's how they achieve good intonation, is they fret and then they lift off a little bit and slide. So it seems like, you know, they've got built-in auto-tune or something, or Melodyne going on. But no, I mean, Joe Walsh, he just does it. He is accurate, but in such a soulful way. And that's, technically speaking, that is really something, you know. But then he never makes you feel like you're noticing that or thinking about it. You know what I mean? It's just so musical all the time. And that's the way he sings. That's the way he plays keyboards as well as masterful guitar.
I know that you and ZZ have been working to document the history of G3. So you've had a lot of time to consider everything about it. Like, with hindsight, what do you kind of appreciate about the original G3 tour, from the conceptual idea to the end of the execution of that first outing on the road?
It was amazing that it happened. It really was, because it started with such a simple complaint. Me walking into Bill Graham offices and saying, thanks guys, you know, I've got a career and I can play whatever I want, but how come I'm all alone? It's like, I'm never hanging out. And it was, you know, it was part of my teenage dream that you'd be partying all the time with all the cool guitar players and musicians. And, but it wasn't like that at all. You were either stuck on a bus, in a hotel room, or you were just doing the gig, but it was just isolation started to really bother me. And, I thought, well, the only way to really do it is to, you know, stand next to these guitar players that you love, that frighten you, that, you know, make you wonder, like, how does that work? How do they do it? You know? And I thought, that's the only way to move forward with your musicianship, is to be challenged, but not like every other, you know, month or every other year. It's like every night. I had a hunger for that. That's what I wanted, that challenge. And maybe because, you know, growing up, that's kind of like what it was like, you know, kids just trying to outdo each other all the time. But it was fun. We enjoyed it, you know, and there wasn't this outside world like on the internet. We weren't adults, so we couldn't, you know, go wherever we want anytime. We were stuck in our communities. And so we spent a lot of time playing with each other. And that sort of separation of being an adult just started to gnaw at me, you know. So, you know, it did take a year from me saying, what can we do? What can we invent that gets me on stage with great guitar players every night? You know, and it took a year to convince the promoters and the managers and the artists that it was going to be great, because the audience is, they're going to love it. I said to try to assuage the artist's fears, I said, the audience has already made up their mind who their favorite is. So don't think that it's about you changing their minds that you're actually better than the other guy. I said, forget about that. They don't think like that. They love music. They love guitar playing. They're going to be so happy that we're standing next to each other, and they get more all at once. And they love the individuality. And they were skeptical. Every artist gets very skeptical and they get very nervous and there's an anxiety around it. But as soon as they play the first gig, they realize that it's an unnecessary fear, because it's not there. We do celebrate the instrument with the audience. That's what's happening.
How did you meet Eric Johnson?
I met him in 1990, that's when we started touring together. We were on the Flying in a Blue Dream tour, Jonathan Mover, Stuart Hamm, and myself. And we had the opportunity to do a string of dates with Eric opening up. I started to ask Eric to come out at the end of our set and improvise, and we would just make things up. I don't even think we ever played songs. I think we'd say like B minor, reggae, you know, and we'd just go for a while. And I just really loved that. I just thought, oh, this is great. I was such a big fan of his. I thought he was so unique, especially the fact that he was a Texas guitar player. He just didn't sound like all the other guitar players out of Texas that I could see. You know, he had something else going on that was so deep. And he was a very interesting person, off stage, and really, really good guy. And I thought, wow, I'd love to be able to do something in the future. But back then there wasn't a whole lot of people looking to collaborate in the world of guitar players. They were still sort of gunning for each other, which is so silly, but that's the entertainment business.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's what people like. You take a lot of what G3 is for granted now because it just seems so natural. Like, it's like, why wouldn't there be a tour of all these guys together? But that really is the thing. It's like, you just have to remember that this was not happening on that scale. Like, you kind of illustrated that. Like, you could have somebody like Eric that ends up opening some dates for you because maybe the promoter goes, oh, let's take this guitar player and put this with this other guitar player. But they're just looking at it as an opening act. They're not necessarily looking at whoever they place on your bill or on Eric's bill as somebody that's going to bring additional tickets other than, you know what, they're both guitar players, so maybe it'll help. It can't hurt. That was about as far as it went back then. So it's like, it's really kind of cool when you consider just how much the whole thing changed the scene for so many people. And I guess that leads into something I'd wanted to ask you, which is, how did it move things forward for you? Like, what were kind of the interesting metrics that you saw as a result of going out and doing that tour? Because you already had like a decent profile. Like, did you see a pretty good lift for going out and doing that?
Yeah. The biggest change, I think, was in when you look back, the summer of 88, our European tour consisted of 3 shows. You know, this is crazy. But we did it anyway. You know, we played Montreux, we played Paris, and we played the Marquee in London. And we actually did an unannounced show at Town and Country, but it was like 6 people showed up or something. I don't know. But, you know, that when you look at how difficult it is to reach people to come out and see you play at a club or a small theater, it really shows you that getting the word out and getting your music in front of people so they can listen to it and decide whether or not they want to take it into their lives, you know, it's so hard. And anything you can do to gain an audience is really important, I think. And it kind of goes without saying, but you really do have to take almost any gig that people ask you to do. You know, I knew that from when I was in high school, that no matter what it was, just go do it. It might be goofy, it might be scary, but just try it. Someone will see it, you know. And basically that's what happened each time that we would step up and something new would happen. For instance, the Montreux Festival, Montreux Jazz Festival, we were supposed to play at midnight, I think. We didn't go on until 4 in the morning. I remember we played the first few bars of Ice Nine and everyone except for about 12 people got up and left. But there were cameras, really nice cameras, and they shot this thing without pointing the cameras to the audience. And we were so upset that Carlos Santana made us wait so long to go on. And we went out and we said, you know what? We need this. So let's just make the cameras think that we're in front of 20,000 people. And we went out there as a joke and we sort of hammed it up. But that got us this extra audience that thought, well, this is what these guys do. You know, they wear weird clothes and jump around. They don't sing and they just jam and improvise, you know. And, you know, it that got us other gigs. So when we were invited back to Europe, we had a full tour. And so the G3 had the same kind of effect because it showed that these people aren't just isolated, you know, Steve Vai in his world, Eric Johnson in his world, Joe in his world. It showed that we're actually all together and that the audiences are a broad selection of the American audiences enjoying it. That was what was so important about the live album and the DVD, was to show that it was a good time. We had a good time playing fun music in front of people, and we were shredding like crazy. And I think that legitimized it. And then we got offers from all around the world. And that's, you know, that was a risk that all three of us took because our careers were kind of on the line in a way. Like, you know, like you might be able to do it alone, but can you do it standing next to two other amazing guitar players, you know? Yeah. Does your music hold up to their music? Do you know how to improvise? Do you get faked out? Do you fold? You know, do you wilt? But nobody wilted, you know what I mean? And I think that added this legitimacy to not only each of us individually, but also as the concert series, as a force of its own.
The tour through the years, like, what's the one that got away, the guitarist that you all wanted to have on the tour that for one reason or another didn't work out? Like, and I guess specifically, I wonder, like, you know, there's this thing that you got various guitar players, but if they came out, maybe they were in a band, but they came out with you guys and they played instrumentally. So I wondered, like, for example, was Eddie Van Halen ever on the list of possibilities on the drawing board anywhere?
I called Eddie's number, office, whatever, almost every time. And I didn't want to be a pest, but, you know, I didn't know him, so I couldn't, you know, just call his house or stop by. I don't live in the same city. So I would go through channels and, you know, I tried every angle to say, we'll take care of everything, which we do, myself and my manager. We took care of all the technicalities of putting on this show, and we made it so that it was the easiest thing for the artist to come. And in terms of Ed, I always made the offer that we could put the band together. He could play whenever he wanted. He could play for as long as he wanted. But this was basically the structure of the show. And I never heard back. I mean, I literally never heard back. So I suppose maybe after six or seven G3 tries, I just thought, well, it's cool because not everybody is comfortable standing next to two other guitar players every single night. They may do it once at a special show, charity event or something, you know, really big. But once you sign on to G3, it's a responsibility to the audience to show up every night and play, you know. The other thing is, certain bands provide enough for their guitar players to do whatever they want. So, you know, The Edge, right? He can do whatever he wants in U2, and so could Eddie Van Halen. It's not like he needed G3 because he had all this other music that he wanted to play, or his band didn't let him play guitar, you know? So
yeah,
I've always realized, yeah, it's not for everybody, not, you know. But I did, that one did get away. The one that was so close to really happening was me with Jeff Beck and Billy Gibbons. And I think we were a week away from actually, you know, putting it with ink in the books. It was so close to happening. And then Jeff bailed at the last moment. The excuse he said is he thought it would be better if we toured with Prince. And I took that as a really good joke. Like, he just didn't want to do it. So he came up with the most ridiculous suggestion that couldn't be, you know. So I met Jeff twice, but I can't say I really knew him. So I there was no way for me to ever talk to him about it. Like, why didn't it happen? But I always thought in my mind, like, oh, yeah. You know, let's call up Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck and, let's get all your favorite guitar players out there. And it's difficult because they, you know, I'm a different generation. We're you know, Steve and I we're kind of in the middle, to tell you the truth. Especially me at my age, I'm just like, right, I'm not part of the classic rock group. I'm not part of the group that really took off afterwards, and, you know, iconic guitar players like Slash or Tom Morello or whatever. And so I could see that. I could see them just wondering, like, who is this kid? We don't know who he is, you know, plays instrumental guitar. Who cares, you know? So I never really thought it would happen, but I'd ask anyway. And, you know, once in a while, somebody would agree or would just show up and say, I want to play. And it would be like Brian May or Neil Sean or Robert Fripp, you know. So we've been really fortunate in that respect. And but, yeah, those are the two that got away, certainly Jeff Beck and Edward. Yeah.
Yeah. I spoke with Steve Vai earlier this week, and I kind of love that he still has, like, he showed them to me. I love that he still has, like, the original guitar lessons that you, like, wrote out for him. Like, it's like, you know, there's usually a guy in every band, but in this case, you guys being individuals, like, somebody is either somebody that is an archivist type of person or they're not. So it's just like, I loved seeing that he still had that stuff from literally 50 years ago. That speaks a lot to the dynamic of you two.
Yes. Yeah. I remember him as a 12-year-old kid. It's really hard for me not to think of him as, you know, the young kid from my town, you know, who I thought was just supremely talented and was just going to go, you know, he was a shooting star. I knew that when he was 12. Very exciting. And And we're, you know, we're talking almost every day. We're writing and recording a new album right now. So it's really fun. And because we're still here doing it and we still love it and we still have the craziest ideas that we're throwing at each other. Like, what? You want me to play what? So it's fun.
I think that says a lot. Like, you know, he knows, and this is where I'm going to wrap, but like, he knows the buttons to push with you. And you know the buttons to push with him. It's like it seems like he's somebody that can challenge you in a way that perhaps other folks wouldn't know to.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And I've told him, I mean, he sent a song yesterday and I thought to myself, oh, here's another Steve Vai thing. Like, and I said to him, how am I ever going to remember how to play something like this? It's like, you know, but I said, I trust you because every time you throw these weird things out, I move forward. I figured it out. So I just said, you got to give me a couple of days to work on it.
Well, Joe, congrats on this new G3 reunion live release. Congrats on the upcoming continuing dates with Steve. It's all going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be a fun year. You got the Vegas residency with Sammy. As always, man, you got a lot on your plate, and it's always good to speak with you, sir.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. There you have it. Another episode of the UCR Podcast is in the books. I am Matt Wardlaw. Thank you so much to all of you for listening. Please make sure to follow this podcast if you haven't, so you will get future episodes as they're released. And we'd appreciate it also if you would rate and review the podcast wherever you're listening. Look, we are all music fans, so if you enjoyed this, you can find a lot more at ultimateclassicrock.com, and we'll see you there.